It's hard to have fun when your feet hurt. Hiking, working, or dancing are challenging. What can you do about foot pain? This is the People's Pharmacy with Terry and Joe Graydon.
We usually take our feet for granted until we have problems. It's amazing how many things can go wrong with our feet. Blisters, bunions, corns, and calluses are just a few of the foot problems people experience.
Then there are also heel spurs, plantar fasciitis, and athlete's foot. Some people experience hammer toes. What is that? And is there anything that can be done about it?
What should you know about pedicures? Some people contract serious infections at the nail salon.
Coming up on the People's Pharmacy, your calls and questions about foot problems.
In the People's Pharmacy Health Headlines, there's another huge reversal in dietary advice. First, we were told to avoid eggs, and then we learned eggs are just fine. We were warned to use margarine instead of butter, and then it turned out that trans fats in most margarines are worse for our health than butter. For decades, we've been told that eating red meat, especially processed meat, is almost tantamount to a death wish. No wonder the current issue of Annals of Internal Medicine has created such a stir. It presented four different analyses of nutritional data showing that any health hazard from eating red meat is modest at best. One meta-analysis reviewed the results of 100 studies, including a total of 6 million participants. It revealed that dietary patterns, including the amount of meat people usually consume, don't have a big impact on people's likelihood of getting cancer and dying prematurely. Another analysis looked at cohort studies that considered how reducing red meat consumption affects the risk of cancer and early death. It, too, involved 6 million people in 118 studies. It showed only a small benefit from reducing the amount of meat people eat. A third study looked at cardiovascular consequences of eating meat. You guessed it. The risk in these cohort studies was tiny. Finally, the researchers analyzed results from randomized controlled trials comparing diets with different amounts of meat. Such studies are considered the gold standard for medical research. In these 12 studies, red meat had little or no effect on major cardiometabolic outcomes and cancer mortality and incidence. The backlash has been intense. Many nutrition scientists strongly disagree with the conclusions of these analyses. An accompanying editorial points out that other reasons besides health might inspire people to reduce their meat consumption. Animal welfare and environmental conditions are both considerations.
Another controversial dietary recommendation has to do with fish oil. Is it helpful or useless when it comes to heart disease? Epidemiologists reported that the Greenland native Inuits had much lower rates of heart disease. They attributed this benefit to foods high in marine fatty acids. Subsequent studies of fish oil produced mixed results. Randomized controlled trials published in the New England Journal of Medicine found no cardiovascular benefit from omega-3 fatty acids. Now, a comprehensive meta-analysis by renowned Harvard scientists has found that people taking fish oil supplements have a lower risk of heart attacks, heart disease, and death from cardiovascular disease. The higher the dose, the greater the benefit. There were 13 randomized controlled trials in this analysis with more than 120,000 participants. The weight of the evidence now suggests that omega-3 supplements can save lives.
Scientists at the University of California, Irvine have made a fascinating discovery. They've identified the mechanism by which some traditional botanical medicines lower blood pressure. Lavender, chamomile, and fennel all activate a specific potassium channel called KCNQ5. Some other herbs also affect this channel. This potassium channel is able to make blood vessels relax, lowering blood pressure. The small molecule allopurine is responsible for this activity in the Chinese herb Sophora flavescens. No modern antihypertensive drugs use this mechanism of action, but further research on this and related potassium channels might yield some new approaches to keeping blood pressure under control.
Sepsis is a life-threatening condition in which the body's response to infection causes widespread inflammation, resulting in shock and organ damage. A new study of high-dose intravenous vitamin C looked at whether this treatment could reduce organ damage compared to placebo. It didn't. However, an unexpected finding was a dramatic difference in survival. 46% of the patients who received placebo had died after a month. This compared to 30% mortality in the vitamin C group. And that's the health news from the People's Pharmacy this week. Welcome to the People's Pharmacy. I'm Joe Graydon. I'm a pharmacologist.
And I'm Terry Graydon. I'm a medical anthropologist. Have you ever had foot problems? Foot pain can really slow you down. It's hard to walk when your feet hurt. That can interfere with your job, and it can definitely keep you from having much fun. You can't hike, play tennis, go dancing, or practice karate. How can you manage your foot problems so they don't mess up your life?
To help us answer that question, we turn to Dr. Jane Anderson. She is board certified in foot surgery by the American Board of Podiatric Surgery. Dr. Anderson practices at In Stride Chapel Hill Foot and Ankle Associates in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. She specializes in foot and ankle care for children, adults, athletes, and geriatric patients, including surgery and conservative care. Welcome back to the People's Pharmacy, Dr. Jane Anderson.
Hello, and thank you for having me back. I appreciate it.
We also invite you to join the conversation. Have you suffered from bunions? Perhaps you've had heel spurs. Dr. Jane Anderson is ready to answer your questions. The number is 888-472-3366. And you can email us, radio@peoplespharmacy.com. The number to share your story again, 888-472-3366.
Now, Dr. Anderson, I'm thinking back to like maybe high school biology, and I had a teacher who said that there are like more bones in your feet than just about any other part of your body. Is that really true?
That is true. So each foot has 26 bones, so that equals 52, and there are 208 bones in the human body, so 25% of your bones are in your feet.
What about like muscles and ligaments and all of those?
Many. And, you know, you don't realize that there are a lot of muscles in your foot. There are some of the muscles that control your feet are in your lower leg, but there are what we call intrinsic muscles inside the foot that are very tiny, that have very specific little jobs, mostly controlling your toes.
And I'll tell you, when you do realize it, when you get a cramp affecting those toes.
Yes. Sometimes I get a cramp that just affects my fourth toe on my left foot, if you can imagine. So there's one little tiny muscle that does that.
Ah. And now, Dr. Anderson, I'd like to ask you a question about podiatry. So you're a doctor of podiatry. You actually did a residency at a very reputable, wonderful place, Stanford University. Can you tell us about the education of a podiatrist, please?
Sure. So it's actually Doctor of Podiatric Medicine, DPM is our degree. And when you do the same pre-med education that you would if you were going the allopathic medical school route, then you would apply to one of the podiatric medical schools there are 9 of them in the country. It's a 4-year program. It's similar to allopathic medical school. We study many of the same things, but we add in things like biomechanics and foot surgery and things that they probably wouldn't touch on. And then we do a 3-year residency program. And that can vary. It can be emphasis in diabetes care, or you can have an emphasis in sports medicine or just general podiatric medicine and surgery.
Now, I think when a lot of people consider their feet, if they do at all, it's like, oh, something hurts. The idea of going to a podiatrist to find out about the rest of your body seems a little counterintuitive. And yet, if you were to ask, for example, an ophthalmologist, they say, well, hey, the eyes, they're the window to the soul. And not only that, we can see stuff going on in the brain back there at the retinal level. And if you talk to an oral surgeon or a dentist, they'll say, "Oh yeah, we see things.
We can pick up on general health problems by looking for the ophthalmologist in the eye or for the dentist or oral surgeon in the mouth." Does the same thing happen with podiatric medicine?
Absolutely. So we pick up on a lot of different things. I think most commonly maybe diabetes. You know, people come in with numbness and tingling in their feet. Vascular disease, if their pulses aren't very good. Sometimes certain types of arthritis.
What do you mean by pulses?
Oh, so, you know, you have a pulse in your wrist. You have two pulses in your feet and in each foot. And those are kind of a little window as to what your cardiovascular system is doing. If you don't have a strong pulse, that means you're not getting enough blood down to your feet, which means your ability to heal something is diminished. But it also could indicate other things. There was a study that we had talked about before about AFib. So they talked about people who were evaluating foot pulses that they could feel some irregularities and perhaps pick up on things that may need to be worked up with AFib. I practice in a community which is a very healthy community and goes to their doctor pretty frequently. So that's not usually what I'm picking up on, but there are several things. You know, arthritis, rheumatoid arthritis, psoriatic arthritis, psoriasis, gout, you know, any number of things. I had a patient in recently who she was having a radiating pain to her foot, and it was really annoying, and it just didn't fit any pattern of any anatomical thing with the foot. And I said, you need to get your lower back checked out. And as it turns out, she had a cyst that was pressing on a nerve in her lower back.
Okay. And gout makes a lot of sense to me, because what we frequently hear from people is the big toe is the first joint to announce a bad gout attack. So I imagine that you do see that from time to time.
We do see quite a bit of it. And when you see a patient with a red hot swollen big toe joint, which is usually the first sign of gout, you have to make sure there's not something else going on, like an infection. But there are certainly a lot of medications that we use for that. Sometimes we'll use a cortisone injection if we know they have gout and we want to calm it down. Interesting thing, gout has kind of evolved, and there's a lot of research that's kind of coming to the forefront about high fructose corn syrup and how that the increase in that in our diet has led to kind of an increase in gout in the general population. So it's kind of interesting.
I asked a gout specialist several months ago why the big toe. It was not exactly the best answer I've ever received. And I was like, really? I mean, the big toe gets more circulation than the little toe? I mean,
yeah. Well, actually, it's really that it's the coldest part of your body, if you think about the blood getting from your heart. So gout is a crystalline disease. There's crystals floating around in your bloodstream, and you know, they're going to crystallize out. This uric acid is in your bloodstream. It's going to crystallize out. It chooses the coldest part of your body. So your first metatarsal phalangeal joint, which is your big toe joint, is the furthest thing from your heart as opposed to your elbow or your knee or your hip or something. So that's why it typically shows up in the big toe. So
although I would imagine the fifth metatarsal might also be just as chilly.
Yeah, except that fifth metatarsal phalangeal joint is not as significant as a joint or as well.
Doesn't carry as much weight.
Right. Exactly.
Okay.
So the answer was probably right.
I would agree.
Okay. Now, there are some what I would call occupational hazards to being a podiatrist. People take off their shoes and their socks, and sometimes, whoo-wee, smelly feet. I guess you have to keep a straight face when that happens. Why do some people have such smelly feet, and what can they do about them?
Well, there are a lot of reasons, and if you certainly have a foot odor problem, you could ask the advice of your podiatrist. You know, some people are just more prone to that. If your feet are particularly sweaty, if you have a fungal infection, if you don't practice good foot hygiene, that's another thing. Most people who come to see me are pretty conscious about that. They're going to clean their feet before they come and make sure. But, you know, there's some things to watch out for. If you have particularly sweaty feet, if you think you might have a fungal infection, you should see your podiatrist, because sometimes controlling those things can actually improve your quality of life.
How about tea soaks?
So one of the holistic things I recommend for sweaty feet is brew some, you know, regular old English black tea, let it cool, soak for 30 minutes once a day for probably about 10 days, and then you can decrease to maybe two or three times a week. And the tea, the tannic acids, dry out the sweat glands, and it works kind of nicely for some people.
Well, we're going to the phones to take a call. Marcy in Columbia, South Carolina, welcome to the People's Pharmacy. Tell us your story, please.
Yes, I'm so grateful because it started just yesterday, and it's scary to me. I have 14 steps going up to my bedroom, and what I'm finding is the left foot, ankle around under my ankle bones. In fact, I'm grasping it with my right hand. It's very painful going down the stairs, not coming up and not on a flat surface. But I sprained that ankle about 4 or 5 years ago, but it hasn't been a problem since.
Marcy, is it on the inside of your ankle or on the outside of your ankle?
Well, it's actually, I'd have to start walking down the stairs to tell you accurately, but it's under, just under that part of my foot. And I feel like I have to wince.
So it sounds, you know, there's a lot of structures on either side of the ankle that could be contributing to your discomfort. It sounds a little bit like maybe a tendon problem, a tendonitis, or something along those lines. If what I would recommend is just kind of take it easy, ice it, elevate it. And if it's still painful next week, call your podiatrist. You can find a podiatrist at APMA.org. That's our national organization has a nice find a podiatrist tool on there, and you should have it checked out. If it's red or hot or swollen or anything along those lines, then you definitely want to get that checked out sooner than later.
You are listening to Dr. Jane Anderson. She's board certified in foot surgery by the American Board of Podiatric Surgery. Dr. Anderson practices at InStride Chapel Hill Foot and Ankle Associates in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. And you can ask her a question at 888-472-3366.
After the break, we'll take more of your calls about foot problems. Have you suffered from bunions? And what about foot pain? How it really impacts your life?
Have you ever had a pedicure? Are there unanticipated dangers you should be aware of?
Give us a call. Share your thoughts and your stories about corns, calluses, nail fungus, and plantar fasciitis. That number again, 888-472-3366. If our lines are full, you can email us, radio@peoplespharmacy.com.
You're listening to The People's Pharmacy with Joe and Terry Graydon.
Welcome back to The People's Pharmacy. I'm Joe Graydon.
And I'm Terry Graydon. The People's Pharmacy is brought to you in part by Verizana, an analytical laboratory providing home health tests for hormones, gut health, and the microbiome. Online at verisana.com.
And by CocoVia, maker of high-potency cocoa flavanol supplements that support cognitive and cardiovascular health. More information at CocoVia, that's COCOAVIA.com.
also by Mighty Muscadine grapeseed and skin products. Natural supplements, juice, snacks, and more containing antioxidants that research indicates may support cardiovascular, immune system, and joint health. Information online, mightymuscadine.com.
Today we're talking about foot problems with podiatrist Dr. Jane Anderson. She is board certified in foot surgery by the American Board of Podiatric Surgery. Dr. Anderson practices at InStride, Chapel Hill Foot and Ankle Associates in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. She specializes in foot and ankle care for children, adults, athletes, and geriatric patients, including surgery and, what I like best, conservative care.
Dr. Anderson, we have an email from Philip who says, what could cause muscles in my feet and calves to cramp at 4 o'clock in the morning, waking me up in unrelenting pain? And what can he do about it?
You know, it's funny that this year, and I think it's because of the heat, I have had more patients complain of cramping in their feet and legs than I've ever had before. So certainly I tell people to increase your fluid intake, to increase your water, you know, not right before you go to bed, obviously, but it's earlier. That's the first step. The second step is to do some stretching exercises before they go to bed. But sometimes adding some supplements in. One of the things I love that people actually do well with is actually having a tablespoon of yellow mustard before they go to bed. And I think that that has been very helpful. And magnesium is the other one.
Now, so you're actually suggesting the mustard before they go to bed as a preventive, because we have heard about this and used it when the cramp hits.
Yes. And it's very, and that's
and
true.
And it works fast.
Right. And, but logistically, who has mustard in their bedroom? Right.
So, well, you could keep a little packet
right,
there.
Right. But so with some of my patients, I kind of recommend try it preventatively. And if it doesn't work, you can use it when the cramp hits. But magnesium citrate actually worked for me. I was having terrible foot cramps this summer, leg cramps. And I started taking magnesium citrate and they completely stopped.
Magnesium does seem to help me as well. Joe and I had an interesting experience. Just recently, we were visiting, so we were in a hotel room. We didn't have mustard. We didn't have anything except raspberries we had bought, and I had a horrible foot. Actually, the muscles at the bottoms of my legs, right above my feet, both legs cramped at the same time, which is pretty unusual, and it was very painful, and I leapt out of bed, and Joe said, have a raspberry. And I thought, raspberry, that's not going to do anything. It worked, which was quite a surprise.
Well, we think there's an actual mechanism. The TRP channels in the mouth, throat, and in the upper stomach may respond to interesting flavors like mustard, like quinine, and now maybe even like raspberries. Terry, I've got an email that I need to share because this is a problem that I suffer with. KJ asks, I am extremely flat-footed. Can there be some exercises to strengthen the arch? Now, I am equally super flat-footed, just like KJ. And I'm wondering, I mean, is there anything anybody can do when they're that flat?
Generally, you know, you can do some exercises of your feet to kind of improve your musculature. Generally, if it depends on where you are in the stage of flat feet. If you have had flat feet your entire life and you're 60 years old, you're probably not going to change the structure of your foot with exercise. So in those people, oftentimes we will have them, you know, wear good shoes and consider orthotics, which are inserts that go inside their shoes. You know, the more it's interesting because even a patient with extraordinarily flat feet that it does not have a flexible flat foot cannot wear an orthotic comfortably or can only wear a minimal orthotic. So every flat foot, you know, a lot of them progress to the point where they can't be manipulated or they can't be supported in a comfortable fashion. So if we can address them earlier, that's better. And that's where exercises might be more helpful at a younger age.
Why do some people have super flat feet and other people have super high arches? Is it just
genetics,
in our genes?
Genetics, yeah.
Okay.
There you go. We have an email from Jeanette. She says, I'm a runner and I have a significant bunion on my left foot. The surgical consults all end in the admonition that post-procedure I will be in a boot for more than 6 months. Are there any other options? I can't hang up my running shoes for half a year.
So I'm a big fan of conservative care. And this is kind of an interesting thing with running and bunions. I feel like, you know, some people have deep joint pain with bunions and they do well with orthotics. Sometimes we'll do other treatments as well. But when you have pain just from the pressure on the side of the shoe, finding a wider shoe is sometimes helpful. There is actually a brand of running shoes that's on the market now that's been out for, I don't know, 5-6 years called Altra, A-L-T-R-A. And they are literally the widest shoes, the widest toe box you could ever buy in a running shoe. So some people with bunions do well with those. Other people just have kind of chronic pain. So typically when I do a bunionectomy, I will tell people they'll probably be in the boot for usually 6 to 8 weeks. It's not 6 months in a boot, but I usually tell them they'll have to avoid running or high impact exercises for probably around 12 to 14 weeks. So during that time, it depends on what kind of bunionectomy you have, because there are many, many types. It depends on, you know, what you can do postoperatively depends on which type you had. So there's some people when 3 or 4 weeks hits, I say go to the gym and get on the stationary bicycle and, you know, do your thing. And there are other people where that's not appropriate. So it just depends on what you're signed up for in a sense.
Okay. Now we've got another question about bunions and surgery. And so we go to Fran in Rocky Mountain, North Carolina to find out about that. Fran, please give us your question, please.
Oh, hi, Joe and Terry. This is Fran, and I had a bunionectomy in 2001 in the office and woke up in the middle of it here in the fall and was put back under. When the surgery was over, I had a cast up to my knee and the tip of my toes, and 8 weeks later when it was removed, they took a pin out, and I had a number of stitches, about 2.5 inches long, a scar, and there was a spread between my big first toe and second toe of an inch or so, and about a half inch between the next toe and the third toe. The foot has never been the same size as the other foot, and shoes have now been a problem for years. So I was so afraid now to have the second foot done that I didn't. Why was my surgery so confusing, and why did I end up with such a spread between the toes and have a larger problem as I had before?
Well, we don't know if Dr. Anderson will be able to answer that question since it was somebody else who did the surgery, but let's see what she has to say.
So there are a lot of different factors when we look at a bunion and how to fix it. And we measure angles of the bones and we choose our procedures based on how bad your bunion is on the radiograph, on the x-ray. But we also look at what's your lifestyle, what's your age, your health, things like that. And when you're fixing a bone, oftentimes it involves cutting a bone and putting in screws or pins or something along those lines. And sometimes when you move that bone over a little too much, your big toe can go off to the other side. So you get the reverse of a bunion. And we call that a hallux varus. And it's a very delicate balance because once you move that metatarsal over to get rid of the bunion, you know, you want it to function in the right position and you want it to move, the joint to move freely. And sometimes if you move it just a little too much, then the big toe can go the opposite way. So it is a little intimidating sometimes when that happens. It doesn't happen very often, but sometimes it does. And some people don't have any problems with it, and other people need to have follow-up surgery. So, you know, it's something, I understand your concerns, but it may not happen again if you have your other one fixed.
And we go to Joan in Branson, Missouri. Welcome to the People's Pharmacy, Joan.
Well, thank you, and thank you for taking my call. I have a serious issue with my feet. My toes are froze all the time. I can't sleep without a heating pad, and then my feet are numb. When I first get up in the morning, I have a hard time acclimating instead of walking, and a serious neuropathy, I think, and may not be out of Dr. Kane's category, but surely she's seen it before. How can your feet be numb and your toes be froze?
So numbness in the feet is called neuropathy, and there are multiple reasons for neuropathy, and that's one of the things that you have to make sure, like when someone comes to me and they have numb feet and I diagnose neuropathy, we have to know why you have neuropathy. And there are many, many reasons. The most common reasons are diabetes and alcohol. So you have to make sure that, are you seeing your doctor on a regular basis? Have you been screened for diabetes at your regular checkups to make sure that that's not a factor? But there are multiple other reasons. And I think the next most common cause is what we call idiopathic neuropathy.
Mm-hmm. Which means we don't know.
We don't know. Doctors are idiots. That's how I always say. And that is something that is hard to control. So, but there are other things like vitamin deficiencies and things. So you want to make sure that you are controlling anything that you can control, but you may not be able to control those symptoms. Sometimes people will have symptoms because they're having a problem with their lower back. And it can be pressing on the nerves. So you want to make sure that that's not an issue as well.
Sometimes medications can cause neuropathy or nerve pain or numbness and tingling. And so it's important to ask your doctor and your podiatrist, could my statin, for example, that I'm taking for my cholesterol cause neuropathy? Could it be some other medication? That may not mean you can stop the drug, but at least it might identify the problem.
Exactly.
We go to Julie in Sarasota, Florida. Welcome to the People's Pharmacy, Julie.
Hi there. So 30 plus years ago, I was pretty young and I had a trimalleolar fracture of my left ankle. And now fast forward, I've been pretty active and now I've been getting a lot of cortisone injections and I'm looking to get either an ankle fusion or an ankle replacement. I like the idea of an ankle replacement, but they seem to say that I'm too young for that because the fusion is much more common surgery. And so I was curious to find out, because you like the conservative approach, what you think, like how often is too often for the cortisone injections and what your opinion is between the ankle fusion and the ankle replacement surgery.
How old are you?
I'm 52.
Okay. So conservatively, most people kind of use the rule of thumb for cortisone maybe once every 6 months or so. And then you start thinking about what are the other conservative options. Certainly, you want to do some supplements. You know, you can use turmeric or glucosamine chondroitin, things like that. Those are very safe, but may have minimal impact. There are homeopathic anti-inflammatories like Xeal and Tramiel. There are, regular anti-inflammatories. So my criteria for sending, and I don't do ankle replacements, I'll be honest, a lot of podiatrists do, but that's not in my repertoire. They have, it is really a end stage procedure, either fusion or the ankle replacement. And it is one of those things that you can put it off as long as you want, if that's what you need, as long as it's not affecting your ability to maintain your health with exercise or to maintain your health or you're not causing pain by the way you're walking in other joints. It is something that is a big commitment. So an ankle fusion is, that's it. You're fused, you're done, you won't have any more. The issue with ankle replacements is that they've been around for a while now, but not for 40 years. So we don't know how long they're going to last. And I would not disagree in terms of you being kind of young for that. I think that it is something that you'll have to kind of keep looking into and see how it evolves. If you can hold off, if you can't, the danger of the ankle fusion is that if it breaks down in 30 years, what's going to happen? Do you need it? The ankle replacement is what's going to happen in 30 years if it breaks down.
Well, we've all heard about knee replacements, hip replacements, but I don't think most people think about ankle replacements.
Right.
So this is a thing.
It is a thing, and it's a fairly new field. They had probably in the 80s, they had a bunch of ankle replacements that all failed. And then in the last 10, 15 years, they've had a whole new crop of them that are much more successful.
Now, to turn to a different type of surgery, we have an email from Gabriella who says, can you tell me about corn removal surgery? I've got a corn on my pinky toe. Will it come back if I have it removed?
What is a corn?
And what is a corn?
So this is a very interesting question. So a corn is a thickening of the outer layer of the skin. So people come into my office all the time and they're confused and they point to a corn or a callus and they say, I have a bunion. A bunion is a bony deformity. A corn is a skin reaction. It's a reaction to friction that happens over part of a bony prominence. So if your fifth toe is curved and it rubs against the side of your shoe, you might get a corn, or you might get a corn in between the fourth and fifth toes. And typically what happens is we take an x-ray, we identify why you're getting the corn, what piece of bone is out of whack, and often we remove a little piece of bone. And generally it's a very successful surgery. It's also a fairly easy surgery to recover from.
Excellent. We have a question from Rick in Plano, Texas. He says, I have numbness at the tip of my toes. Is that neuropathy?
It could be very early neuropathy. So neuropathy, the distribution for neuropathy, we call it a stocking glove distribution. What that means is imagine putting a stocking on your foot and it starts at the tips of the toes and you pull it up. So if you're getting early signs of neuropathy, it's most likely or on the tips of the toes. And yes, he should be seen for that just to see if there's anything that could be controlled.
Okay. Nail fungus. It's a constant source of, controversy because the dermatologists say, oh, those home remedies, they're so worthless. Why do you keep telling people to soak their feet in Listerine and white vinegar? That's crazy. We've got drugs that work. What's your thought about nail fungus? A, what causes it? Why do some people get it and other people don't?
Certainly people, there are some people that are genetically prone to nail fungus. It is, you know, you are just the person that's going to contract that. It usually comes from the athlete's foot infection on the bottom of your foot gets in your nails. So if you see anything on the bottom of the foot, scaling, blistering, anything along those lines, or you have itching, treat that problem right away before it gets in your nails. First, prevention is great. Once it gets in your nails, there are a lot of treatments. And the interesting thing, there are some homeopathic things my patients use, and sometimes they have success. However, no one's going to study vinegar and Listerine versus oral Lamisil. No one's going to pay for that study. So we don't know exactly what the success is of those things. There are many, many topical medications that we use. Some we use off-label, some we use, you know, prescription.
You're listening to Dr. Jane Anderson. She's board certified in foot surgery by the American Board of Podiatric Surgery. Dr. Anderson practices at InStride Chapel Hill Foot and Ankle Associates in Chapel Hill, North Carolina.
When we come back after the break, we'll find out how to pick the right athletic shoe for you.
What about street shoes? Is it possible to find shoes that are comfortable and good looking?
The number is 888-472-3366. If you'd like to join the conversation, email us radio@peoplespharmacy.com.
You're listening to The People's Pharmacy with Joe and Terry Graydon.
Welcome back to The People's Pharmacy. I'm Joe Graydon.
And I'm Terry Graydon. The People's Pharmacy is brought to you in part by CocoVia, offering plant-based nutrients in the form of cocoa flavanols for brain and heart health, online at CocoVia.com.
And by Kaya Biotics, probiotic products made in Germany from certified organic ingredients, KAYABiotics.com.
Also by Mighty Muscadine Grape Seed and Skin Products, natural supplements, juice, snacks, and more. containing antioxidants that research indicates may support cardiovascular, immune system, and joint health. Information online, mightymuscadine.com.
Our topic today is how to manage your foot problems. Our guest, Dr. Jane Anderson, a board-certified podiatrist. She does all kinds of foot surgery, and she also practices at InStride Chapel Hill Foot and Ankle Associates in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. She specializes in foot and ankle care for children, adults, athletes, and geriatric patients, including surgery, but also conservative care. And we've heard about some home remedies. So do you have any home remedies that you think would work for nail fungus? Have any people had any success whatsoever with those foot soaks?
I think that everyone that someone has mentioned to me, some people have had partial success with.
Uh-huh.
But it's not consistent by any means. So it's just on a very limited basis.
So give it a shot. If it works, great. If it doesn't, you can move on.
Yes.
We have an email question for you, Dr. Anderson. This one is from Kathy in Wisconsin. She says, I'm a 69-year-old woman with rheumatoid arthritis. The RA has affected my feet. I have bunions on the outside of my foot by my little toes. I get stress fractures in my metatarsal bones, occasionally suffer with plantar fasciitis, and I pronate my feet when walking. My feet are constantly in pain. I have difficulty finding comfortable shoes I can walk in. In the summer, I wear Birkenstocks, but they aren't good in Wisconsin winters. I walk my dogs daily, and I need a comfortable, supportive shoe. Do you have any suggestions?
So there's we talked about the ultras before are pretty wide. So oftentimes patients with rheumatoid arthritis will have a very wide forefoot because they have all these deformities that stem from that part of the foot. So a very wide athletic shoe like an ultra might be good.
Spell that again.
ALTRA. The other thing that might be helpful, there's a brand of shoes that I've kind of started wearing more recently called Atrex, which is spelled A-E-T-R-E-X. And some of their shoes have a very wide toe box. Not all of them, but some of them do. They often have some support and they have memory foam lining. So they're very comfortable.
Oh, comfortable's good.
Yes.
Well, when you talk about wide toe box, mm-hmm. I think you're talking about, the shape of the foot.
Correct.
And so there are a lot of people like me with my flat feet that have a very wide foot. I mean, the toes, it's not pointy. And I'm wondering, do any people have pointy feet?
Most people don't. There are some people that have a little bit of more of that tendency in the shape. But, what I usually tell people is that nothing should touch your toes. When you are standing in your shoes, when you're trying shoes on, nothing should be touching your toes. You should have a little bit of space. You should buy your shoes at the end of the day when your feet are the most swollen. And if you have any, when people come in and, they'll have problems with maybe their fifth toes or something along those lines because a shoe is pressing on it, I encourage them to look at the last of the shoe, which is the shape of the shoe. So there are some shoes that are much more curved and they put more pressure on the outside of the foot if you have a very straight square foot or a straight last shoe. The other thing I tell people is stand on a piece of paper, trace your foot. Take that piece of paper to the shoe store, and if you put that shoe on top of the tracing and you can see your toes on the outside, it is not the shoe for you.
Do not buy that shoe.
Well, it's not.
That sounds smart.
We think about women wearing, 4-inch spiky heels and a very pointy toe mm-hmm. area. But it's not just women. It's men. When we were in Europe this summer, a lot of young men were wearing these really long shoes that were pretty pointy at the end. And I was thinking, wow, how does that work exactly? Because there's got to be about 2 inches of no toe.
It really depends on the shape of the foot and the size of the shoe. So if you're trying to cram your foot in there and your fifth toe is being pushed over and your toes are being pushed together, then that's not appropriate. If you're wearing it so that it's a little bit longer and you've got enough room across the ball of your foot, then you're probably okay.
Is it possible to get stylish shoes that are also comfortable?
Yes, I really do think so. And I think that, it's much more prevalent now to find that than it was 15 or 20 years ago. There are a lot of brands that kind of tapped into that market of comfortable shoes.
All right. Now, while we're talking about style, let's talk about pedicures. Because a lot of women want to, I don't think so many men, but a lot of women want to have their toenails nicely polished, and they go to the salon to have it done. Are there any dangers in nail salons, foot salons, that we should know about?
So there can be, and some of them are very concerning. So, you know, the worst case scenario is when you develop a skin infection from the Whirlpool tub. So the Whirlpool tub has a filter in it. Even if they clean the tub in between each client, they're not cleaning the filter. And there have been cases where people have developed skin infections on their legs from mycobacterium and required skin grafts. So it is a pretty serious problem. So what I tell people for that thing is when you go to the salon, ask for a basin of water to soak in. No Whirlpool, no nothing bubbly. Even if they put a liner in the Whirlpool, they're still not treating the filter. So that's the first thing. The second thing is, are you going to contract a fungus from the instrumentation? So bringing your own instruments is a great way to kind of keep the that under control. And back to the first problem, don't shave your legs for 24 hours before you go, because those microscopic nicks in your skin are a portal for bacteria to get in.
I've got a question about the instruments, because when you trim your toenails, you use a nail clipper, and that nail clipper goes from toe to toe to toe. So if you've got fungus in your big toe, are you spreading it to the other toes by using that same nail clipper?
You could. It's probably fairly unlikely, but it's, you know, there are a lot of factors that come together with fungus. One of them is pressure on the toenail. So usually we'll see fungus pop up in the first or second toes first because they're getting dinged in your shoes. So any shoe that nail that gets traumatized is more susceptible. That being said, I usually tell people, like, trim your regular nails first and then your fungal nail, and then put it, you know, put your nail clipper in alcohol and only you use it. So it's kind of nice to take that precaution. It may or may not be necessary.
While we're talking about toenails, we've got a question from Roger in Blacksburg, Virginia. Welcome to the People's Pharmacy, Roger.
Hello, Joe and Terry.
Hi, Roger.
I have a question concerning ingrown toenails. I have problems with ingrown toenails on both of my big toes, and the nails on those toes have become thick and tough. Question number one is there a good way to deal with ingrown toenails? And second, is there a way to get those nails to be thinner and more flexible?
So the first question, ingrown toenails, there's a great little procedure we do in the office. It's very simple. We numb up your toe. We take out a little sliver of nail on either side. And sometimes we do it permanently. We kill the root so that little sliver doesn't grow back anymore. That's called a matrixectomy. It is highly successful, and it's a great procedure. When you have a thick nail, sometimes the thickness contributes to the shape. So it would behoove you to kind of maybe get a clipping of the nail taken and sent to see if there is a fungus in there, because you can do a test for that, and possibly treat the fungus as well. So a lot of people come in with this scenario, and usually it's a balancing act with, okay, should we treat the fungus first or should we treat the ingrown toenail? It depends on how much of a problem you have with each one. And especially if there's any redness or swelling along the nail fold, you should have that treated right away.
Thank you for the call, Roger. You're listening to Dr. Jane Anderson. She's answering your questions about foot problems, whether it's heel spurs, gout, flat feet, whatever. Give us a call. 888-472-3366 is the number. You can email us at radio@peoplespharmacy.com. That number again, 888-472-3366. I have one question about orthotics. They can be unbelievably expensive. They're tailored, customized to your feet. Can you get by with off-the-shelf orthotics?
It depends on the pathology, why you need them. Usually, I will start my patients off with something good over-the-counter. And there are good over-the-counters and there are bad over-the-counters.
Some brand names, please.
Yes, the ones I usually like to recommend are Superfeet or Sole. It depends on the reason they're getting them.
And how is Sole spelled?
S-O-L-E.
Okay, just wanted to make sure.
Yeah, I think that the reason most people, I'm sending them for them in most cases, is something like plantar fasciitis, which you need the support. You need a firm device. And so those two are firm orthotics that work well for a lot of people. I would say probably 60% of my patients get away with that. And then the other ones, we sometimes make custom orthotics. And there are other reasons to make custom orthotics that are you know, we can make special modifications for certain diseases and certain pathologies that really need something specific.
And how much should they cost?
It just depends on your doctor and how much they're billing. But usually it's in the neighborhood of $400 to $500 for a pair of orthotics.
And you mentioned plantar fasciitis. What is it and why do so many people complain about it?
Inflammation of the plantar fascia, which is a band of tissue on the bottom of your foot, usually manifests as heel pain when you first stand up in the morning. Extraordinarily common. I think just about everyone has had it at some point or another. Sometimes it's arch pain. I see a lot of it. There are many reasons. I see a big up tick in plantar fasciitis at the end of the summer when people are wearing less supportive shoes, and I see, or walking barefoot. I see it with weight gain. I see it with shoes that are too old. So if your athletic shoes are more than a year old, think about replacing them.
Okay, so barefoot. What about flip-flops?
So flip-flops, there are good and bad flip-flops. Most flip-flops are not, or historically, flip-flops have not been great. But now, over the last 10 to 15 years, we have wonderful brands of flip-flops out there. There's a brand called Vionic, V-I-O-N-I-C, like Bionic, but with a V. They were developed by an Australian podiatrist, and they have arch support. They're tremendous. They're wonderful. But other brands like Atrex, they make flip-flops as well. And so Chacos are great, things like that. So there are...
Chacos?
C-H-A-C-O.
Okay.
So there
you
are
don't want to buy the real cheap flip-flops that are just a slab of plastic.
Those are really good for the shower at the gym.
Okay.
That's the only time you have to wear it.
And that will keep you from getting athlete's foot.
Or warts. Or fungus.
So you can catch all this stuff at the gym.
Yes. Any environment like the locker room, the shower, things like that. So, and just back to flip-flops for a second, there are a lot of really good shoes on the market. There is the APMA, our national organization, actually has tested a bunch of shoes. So if you go to apma.org and look for their seal products, they have the seal of acceptance by the APMA.
Great.
It's a good litmus test to see if it's a good product.
All right. And we go to Dee in Erie, Pennsylvania. Dee, tell us your story, please.
Hi there, Dr. Anderson, Terry, and Joe. 6 months ago, I slight fracture of my ankle bone, the outside ankle bone, and slightly tore a tendon. And now I'm left with soft tissue damage. And I wondered what that was. I never had heard of that.
Do you mean you have your ligaments haven't healed, or do you mean you have swelling, or what do you mean by soft tissue damage?
Swelling. I have swelling, and sometimes the veins stick out a little.
So there certainly can be chronic edema after an injury like that. Sometimes what I'll do is I will refer someone to physical therapy to make sure they're rehabilitated their ankle appropriately. That's important to maintain your ligamentous structure and maintain your proprioception, which is your ability to know where you are in space and prevent further sprains. But also, I'll use compression therapy sometimes, a compression hose, and sometimes I'll evaluate them to see if they've actually developed something like some lymphedema, which is where your lymphatic system isn't draining appropriately. There may be some venous insufficiency issues as well.
Okay, and we go to Ray in Tampa, Florida. Ray, welcome to the People's Pharmacy.
So I'm a cable guy. I work in the field. Always take care of customers during issues. So I'm always on the ladder. I'm kind of a heavy set guy, but I have it feels like a bone spur right above the top part where my pinky toe is. When I push on it, it's kind of painful. It recedes and it comes right back. My father-in-law thinks it might be a blown blood vessel, but it feels like a bone spur.
Is it? It's soft? You can actually manipulate it?
It feels like if I push on it that it moves and that it might be like a bone that's protruding, or it could be like maybe a vein that moves or something. It's painful either way.
So there are normals and multiple soft tissue masses that can occur on the foot that are movable usually. Those things could be a ganglion cyst. It could be a fibroma. It could be a spur, but generally bone spurs aren't movable and relative to the surrounding tissue that they're attached to. So you should definitely have that checked out. Sometimes if it's just removing a cyst or draining a cyst, sometimes if it's a fluid-filled thing, we can drain it right in the office.
So we hear about heel spurs. What are they and what can be done about them?
So heel spurs are just a projection of bone at the attachment of either the plantar fascia or the Achilles tendon. And generally speaking, the spur is not the cause of the pain. So it's usually the plantar fasciitis or the Achilles tendonitis that's causing pain. So once you get that under control and you treat the plantar fasciitis and people are walking around with no pain, guess what? Their spurs are still there. So we know the spurs aren't causing it.
And we're almost out of time, Joe.
We are, but how should you take care of your feet so that when you're in your 20s and 30s and 40s, they don't come back to bite you when you're in your 60s and 70s and 80s?
Wearing good shoes is the first step. Make sure that anything that hurts, you see your podiatrist right away. Don't ignore it. I think that, you know, when I see ladies in their 70s and 80s and they have really terrible feet, they all say, oh, I wore high heels when I was young. So that's one of the things to avoid if you can.
At least as often as possible, don't wear high heels.
Right. Or, you know, wear them on a limited basis. I always say, like, treat it like dessert. You know, if you're going to wear your, if you really want to wear that 3-inch heel when you go out, wear it and then stop. Don't wear it again. You know, don't wear it all day long. It's good to kind of alternate your heel heights and wear things that don't press on your toes.
Okay. Very good advice. Thank you so much, Dr. Jane Anderson. And thank you for listening today. Dr. Anderson is board certified in foot surgery by the American Board of Podiatric Surgery. She practices at InStride, Chapel Hill Foot and Ankle Associates in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. She specializes in foot and ankle care for kids, adults, athletes, geriatric patients, not just surgery, also conservative care.
And Dr. Anderson has consulted for numerous high-profile publications like the Wall Street Journal and many, many others. So she's very knowledgeable.
She is indeed, and we thank you so much for all your practical advice today.
Lynn Siegel produced today's show. Pamela Alberta provided technical assistance. Al Wadarski is our engineer.
The People's Pharmacy is produced at the studios of North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC.
The People's Pharmacy theme music is by B.J. Lederman.
To order today's show or any People's Pharmacy broadcast, you can call 800-732-2334. Today's show is number 1179. The number again, 800-732.
Oh, I'm sorry, Joe. It isn't 1179. It's 1183. 1183. I apologize.
Yeah, but the number, if you'd like to order the show, is 800-732-2334, online at peoplespharmacy.com. And when you go to the site, you can tell us what you think about today's show and tell us what you do for your feet.
Yeah, we'd like to hear. And when you do that, you can also sign up for our free online newsletter or subscribe to the free podcast of the show. And if you sign up for the newsletter, you'll get a free e-guide to favorite home remedies.
And if you listen to the podcast, we'd be very grateful for a review. In Durham, North Carolina, I'm Joe Graydon.
And I'm Terry Graydon. Thank you for listening. Please join us again next week.
And treat your toes and feet with kindness.